Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, July 24, 2025, we talk about type 2 diabetes, gastric cancer, lung cancer, and malaria. A review article on competency-based medical education, a case report of a man with cough, dyspnea, and hypoxemia, and perspectives on brain death in pregnancy, on the Supreme Court's failure to protect trans minors, on real-world data, and on avocado and salt. This week, we feature a new clinical decision on statin therapy for children. This feature about a 10-year-old boy with elevated BMI, lipid levels, and blood pressure offers a case vignette accompanied by two essays, one supporting initiation of statin therapy and the other not recommending statin therapy. We want to know what you would choose. Vote at nejm.org. Weekly fixed-dose insulin efsitora in type 2 diabetes without previous insulin therapy by Julio Rosenstock from Velocity Clinical Research at Medical City, Dallas, and co-authors. Treatment guidelines recommend that patients with type 2 diabetes should receive basal insulin when non-insulin glucose-lowering agents maintain glycemic control inadequately. Thus far, basal insulin regimens in treat-to-target trials have used traditional dosing algorithms, with adjustments to the dose of basal insulin being made at least weekly, according to fasting blood glucose levels. Insulin efsitora alfa is a basal insulin with a flat pharmacokinetic profile and long half-life that allows for once-weekly administration. This Phase 3 treat-to-target trial evaluated whether a fixed-dose regimen of efsitora would provide a benefit in adults with type 2 diabetes who had not received previous insulin therapy. 795 participants were randomly assigned to receive once-weekly efsitora administered in a fixed-dose regimen or once-daily insulin glargine U100. Once-weekly insulin efsitora was non-inferior to insulin glargine in reducing glycated hemoglobin levels in patients with type 2 diabetes who had not previously received insulin. Julie Engelfinger, deputy editor for the journal, and Clifford Rosen from the Maine Health Institute for Research, Scarborough, Maine. Note in an editorial that efsitora is not the first weekly insulin to be developed. Icodec is also a long-acting insulin, and approaches to dose adjustments with various delivery systems for Icodec already exist or are under development. However, the present trial of efsitora by Rosenstock and co-authors potentially offers a ready-made and possibly straightforward algorithm for dose escalation. If packaged at a widely affordable price, efsitora would most likely simplify glycemic control for many persons with type 2 diabetes. In all, weekly or eventually even more widely spaced insulin preparations may facilitate easier to administer insulin and dependable control of diabetes, thus lessening the barriers to the effective therapy of type 2 diabetes. Long-term, formal government approval for efsitora is awaited, and uptake by patients is not yet known. Furthermore, the use of efsitora may depend on coverage, cost, and availability. Finally, the advent of newer or more effective non-insulin hypoglycemic drugs, such as the GLP-1 receptor agonists, which simultaneously also produce weight loss, might ultimately be a more appealing option than efsitora and allow greater patient adherence than weekly insulin in some patients with type 2 diabetes. Despite these unknowns and caveats, the development of even longer-acting insulins now offers promising options for better glucose control in this disease. Trastuzumab deruxtecan, or ramucirumab plus paclitaxel in gastric cancer by Kohei Shitara from the National Cancer Center Hospital East, Kashiwa, Japan, and co-authors. Based on phase 2 studies, the antibody-drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan was approved for patients with HER2-positive metastatic gastric cancer or gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma who had previously received trastuzumab-based therapy. The monoclonal antibody ramucirumab plus the chemotherapy drug paclitaxel is also a standard second-line treatment option regardless of HER2 status. This phase 3 trial evaluated the efficacy and safety of trastuzumab deruxtecan as compared with ramucirumab plus paclitaxel as second-line therapy in 494 patients with HER2-positive metastatic gastric cancer or gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma. Trastuzumab deruxtecan led to significantly longer overall survival than ramucirumab plus paclitaxel among these patients. Adverse events were common in both groups. The occurrence of interstitial lung disease or pneumonitis with trastuzumab deruxtecan, a known risk, were mainly low-grade. Tarlatamab in small cell lung cancer after platinum-based chemotherapy by Yanis Montzios from the Henri Dunant Hospital Center, Athens, Greece, and co-authors. Small cell lung cancer is an aggressive cancer with a 5-year survival below 5% among patients with extensive stage disease. Tarlatamab, a bispecific delta-like ligand 3-directed T-cell engager immunotherapy, received accelerated approval for the treatment of patients with previously treated small cell lung cancer. This study investigated whether tarlatamab would be more effective than chemotherapy in the treatment of patients whose small cell lung cancer had progressed during or after initial platinum-based chemotherapy. 509 patients were randomly assigned to receive tarlatamab or chemotherapy. Treatment with tarlatamab resulted in significantly longer overall survival than chemotherapy. The incidence of adverse events of grade 3 or higher was lower with tarlatamab than with chemotherapy, as was the incidence of adverse events that resulted in treatment discontinuation. Ivermectin to control malaria, a cluster randomized trial by Carlos Shakur from IS Global, Barcelona, and co-authors. Malaria control and elimination is threatened by the spread of insecticide resistance and behavioral adaptation of vectors, such as mosquitoes. This cluster randomized study evaluated whether a mass administration of ivermectin, a broad-spectrum antiparasitic drug that also kills mosquitoes feeding on treated persons, would reduce malaria transmission. The trial was conducted in Kwale, a county in coastal Kenya in which malaria is highly endemic and coverage and use of insecticide-treated nets are high. 84 clusters of household areas were randomly assigned to receive either mass administration of ivermectin or albendazole, the active control, once a month for 3 consecutive months at the beginning of the short rains season. Children 5 to 15 years of age were tested for malaria infection monthly for 6 months after the first round of treatment. Among the children in the trial, ivermectin, administered once a month for 3 consecutive months, resulted in a 26% lower incidence of malaria infection than albendazole. No safety concerns were identified. Richard Steckety, an independent consultant in Bethesda, Maryland, writes in an editorial that these findings were not unexpected, but were the first to show that seasonal mass administration of ivermectin on a monthly schedule could be performed in alignment with other malaria or health interventions and provide a further substantial reduction in transmission. The investigators recognized that the monthly dose would kill mosquitoes for only 10 days after administration and have no killing effect for the remaining two-thirds of the month. It is conceivable that doses could be given more frequently, which would be a challenge for program delivery, or that a longer-acting antiparasitic drug could be identified through future research, thereby leading to a greater reduction in transmission that exceeds the observed 26%. The ability of ivermectin to kill bedbugs, lice, and scabies mites, as well as its approval by multiple regulatory agencies, could facilitate its acceptance in a community and incorporation into malaria programs. Unfortunately, news of this encouraging intervention comes at a dire moment for global public health. Radical funding cuts in staff, commodities, program operations, and research have devastated existing malaria programs in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, as well as the many supporting organizations. Until these resources are restored, continued deployment of currently effective interventions should be prioritized to prevent the undoing of progress and the likely resurgence of malaria.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians, because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple, to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers, so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Competency-based medical education at the front lines of patient care. A review article by Dawn Cooper from Simon Fraser University, Surrey, BC, Canada, and Eric Holmbo from Intelth, Philadelphia. Patients, healthcare professionals, and communities increasingly recognize the urgent need to achieve the quintuple goal of improved population health, health equity, better patient health care, better support for healthcare professionals, and reduced healthcare costs. Yet too many physicians enter the workforce lacking basic clinical and procedural skills and are also insufficiently prepared to work in teams, manage information, and participate in quality improvement. In this review, the authors argue in favor of a competency-based medical education paradigm for training physicians to support the quintuple goal. In this vision, competency-based medical education is an outcomes-focused model that aligns training goals with patient and societal healthcare needs and promotes the journey to mastery among trainees. The authors provide arguments for continued collective work toward this quintuple goal paradigm, despite its current challenges. A 75-year-old man with cough, dyspnea, and hypoxemia. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Asha Anandaya and colleagues. A 75-year-old man with a history of overlapping asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis presented with progressive dyspnea, cough, and hypoxemia. Over the past several months, he had received multiple courses of glucocorticoids and antibiotics for presumed pneumonia and asthma exacerbations. The patient had recently traveled to Central America, and upon return to Boston, he was found to be hypoxic and hypotensive, requiring an ICU admission. Imaging revealed bilateral lower lobe masses and a cavitary lesion in the right upper lobe. His course was complicated by left lung collapse due to mucus plugging and a complex pleural effusion requiring drainage. MRI revealed a small cerebral lesion suspicious for abscess. Sputum and biopsy samples demonstrated filamentous branching gram-positive rods that were acid-fast positive, consistent with Nocardia farcinica. Nocardia is an aerobic branching gram-positive bacterium that causes subacute pulmonary disease and frequently disseminates in immunocompromised hosts. Brain death in pregnancy, abortion, advance directive, or end-of-life law. A perspective by Katie Watson from Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago. Adriana Smith was 8 to 9 weeks pregnant when she was declared brain dead on February 19th of this year. 3 months later, on May 13th, her mother claimed that representatives of Emory Hospital had told her that Georgia's law criminalizing abortion provision after approximately 6 weeks made it illegal to withdraw Smith's ventilator. This post-Dobbs case is reminiscent of the pre-Dobbs 2014 case of Marlies Munoz, who was 14 weeks pregnant when she was declared brain dead. Munoz had a federal constitutional right to abortion until approximately 24 weeks of pregnancy. Yet a Texas hospital claimed that a state statute suspending pregnant people's advance directives made it illegal to follow her family's wishes to have the ventilator withdrawn. In fact, the legal position of both hospitals was incorrect. Yet states with pre-viability abortion bans will probably see increasing numbers of pregnant people with severe brain injury or brain death and no abortion rights. And approximately 30 states, including some that protect abortion access, have advance directive laws like those of Texas. Clinicians, therefore, need to understand whether and how abortion, advance directive, and end-of-life laws apply to these cases in order to protect patients' rights and dignity. The faulty logic behind the Supreme Court's failure to protect trans minors. A perspective by Scott Skinner Thompson from the University of Colorado Law School, Boulder. On June 18th of this year, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming hormonal treatment for transgender minors against an Equal Protection Clause challenge in United States versus Skirmetti. The implications of the court's ruling for these young people and their families, including for the plaintiffs in Skirmetti, for whom such care provided substantial, potentially life-saving health benefits, will be profound. Furthermore, the decision could have important consequences for all Americans, given the court's overly broad deference to lawmakers regarding medical decisions. Under the U.S. constitutional regime, when lawmakers use a suspect classification, such as sex or transgender status, to determine eligibility for medical interventions, the job of courts is to carefully scrutinize whether that classification is closely targeted to achieve an important aim. In this case, the court abdicated that responsibility, and instead of closely scrutinizing whether Tennessee's law actually advanced an important medical interest, casually deferred to state lawmakers. This approach sets a dangerous precedent. The promise of real-world data for research. What are we missing? A perspective by Ali Abbasi from the University of California, San Francisco, and co-authors. The increasing availability of electronic health records, EHRs, and other sources of real-world data could accelerate clinical research by dramatically reducing the cost of generating data and enabling information from medical encounters to be deployed for research and continuous learning. But although 96% of U.S. hospitals have adopted EHRs, these systems were designed to document individual episodes of care and facilitate the highest possible payment for that care, not to support clinical research. Data that aren't required for reimbursement are frequently of low quality and not comprehensive, and many important exposures and outcomes aren't reliably recorded. These limitations directly affect the ability of real-world evidence derived from real-world data to answer important questions faced by clinicians, patients, and policymakers. To achieve the potential of real-world data, federal policymakers could take steps to improve data capture at the point of care, facilitate access to longitudinal whole-person health data, and streamline regulatory practices related to clinical research. Avocado and Salt, a perspective by Grace Yee from the University of California, Los Angeles. The first time this author, a medical student, saw a man die in a trauma bay, it looked kind of like it does in the movies. He died gruesomely in front of his wife and teenage son, amid a flock of medical staff who'd come to rubberneck. Except the blood wasn't fake, and the family's screams were real. As Grace saw more people die, she began to associate the experience less with movies and more with real life. Around 1 a.m. one night, Grace sat alone with a dead man after he'd undergone a last-ditch thoracotomy. He was unnamed, presumed to be unhoused. He had been struck by a car. She pushed his lung, still warm, back inside his skin, now cold. He fit together. Reaching inside him felt like a deep violation, an uninvited intimacy. She gripped the hemostat clamp so hard that her thumb started to blister. She had never tried harder to get her sutures just right. As she worked, she wondered, had he suffered while alive, and did he suffer as he died? Although Grace felt naturally inclined toward emergency medicine, her main hesitation was this. The more time she spent in the trauma bay, the more convinced she was that bad things would happen to people she loves. Tragedy was like a rabid dog. As long as you didn't look it directly in the eye, you might get out unscathed. But perhaps when we understand that pain is inevitable, when we reckon with our own mortality and the mortality of everyone we have ever known, some space opens up. Grace wonders if making physical contact with trauma every day gives us greater capacity to sit with others in their grief and not cower. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a 26-year-old man who had emigrated from Nepal 7 years earlier presented with ankle swelling, cough, unintentional weight loss, and a leg rash. A chest X-ray showed hilar lymphadenopathy. At the current presentation, physical examination was notable for erythematous tender nodules and plaques on the anterior shins. In another image, a 71-year-old woman with systemic lupus erythematosus presented to the ophthalmology clinic for an annual screening examination for hydroxychloroquine-related toxic effects. She had been taking hydroxychloroquine for the past 15 years. She reported no visual changes. A fundoscopic examination revealed a bullseye pattern of hypopigmentation in the macula of both eyes. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.